Okay. So my name is Jeff Fritz, and we're going to talk about cool and elegant ASP.NET web forms with HTML5 and the modern web. Insert buzzword here. No? Come on. Web forms be cool and elegant, right? I mean, this is post-back. This is view state, control tree. Yes, of managing my events, right? Okay, we're going to make this a little bit easier for you guys to handle. Look, are you still using ASP.NET 2? I see a few. Okay, 3.5. Cool, okay. 4. Even more. Okay, so we got about 30, 40% of the room. Cool. And then 4.5 or 4.5.1 or 4.5.2. All right. Who's on 1.1? No? There's some. Usually somebody says that. How about 1? Classic ASP. We have a winner. Ladies and gentlemen, the 90s called. They want their framework back. Look. Remember what happened in 2005 when 2.0 was released? Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans. The bird flu hit. Lance Armstrong won his 7th Tour de France. And he's since given up all of his yellow jerseys. The Xbox 360 was released. I just got mine last year. I don't know. So what? Disneyland celebrated its 50th birthday. And the 6th and final Star Wars film was released. Until Disney had their say. Look, that was a long time ago, okay? And I know there were a couple people here. Is your application still using that 10-year-old technology? Even if you upgraded to 3.5 or 4, are you still using those same programming techniques that we were given first in ASP.NET 2, okay? I know I worked on a couple of projects where that was the case. We still, even though we upgraded to 3.5 and we dropped a generic here and there and we brought in a little MVC, we're still using all of those 2.0 constructs and concepts, okay? Look, the modern problems that you now have, if you are still using those 2.0 techniques, there's a handful of them. I'm going to hit about 7 of them here today. View state, okay? If you're using web forms and you're not handling view state well, I can't harp on it enough. It seems like I always bring this up when I give a talk. There's better ways to deal with view state nowadays, okay? Data source controls. I like to call these the magic gray box. Just sits there in the corner in the designer. Somebody had this great idea to drag this thing in from a toolbox, and it's going to be a gray box that sits there in the corner and delivers data to you. There's better ways to do that nowadays. Smartphone? 2005. There was no smartphone at the time, right? iPhone came out in 2007, so we were building stuff to work on Windows CE. That was great. I loved having a start button on my phone and trying to do Control-Alt-Delete when I needed to reboot on a phone. Not so much. Listen, 49% of 2.23 billion people are using their mobile phone to go online, and they might be visiting your website, okay? Let's make sure we do things to optimize our sites for those phones. That's a lot of people, okay? That's more than, a billion people? 1.1 billion people? I want them to have a good experience when they come to my website so they come back again. Now we've got lots of CSS and JavaScript, right? That's the thing, all these CSS frameworks that came up because we want to be able to do this widget and we want to be able to do that presentation. And now JavaScript frameworks because we need MV star to be able to do this. And single-page application architecture with routing and directives and, wow, let's manage some of that, okay? Ugly URLs. Have you ever tried to explain to somebody a URL to navigate to? Anybody? Right? So when I tell my mother, hey, you got to go check out this website. Go to www.somewebsite.com. I don't want to say /products/ product detail ASPX ?ID equals 14. No. Let's get some better looking things in there so that we can make it easier for us to communicate to those who aren't quite as tech savvy how they can navigate our website. And XHTML was the standard back then. Right? That's not the case now. We want to do HTML5. Let's see how we can upgrade and we can take advantage of HTML5 in today's web forms. Finally, modern security. Anybody shop at Target over the holidays? I did. And then suddenly one day my bank said, we're going to turn off your credit card. Whoa! Okay. Later found out, yes, I was shopping at Target. And things didn't go so well after that. So how can we handle security a little bit better, modern techniques that we can use in our applications with no impact to what we're doing? First thing, if there's nothing else that you do when you leave here, turn off view state. Unless you have something, some reason, and it better be a really good one, turn it off. Don't put stuff into view state that you don't need, okay? Most controls now do not require view state, okay? There are new techniques that allow for controls to manage data without that. We're gonna see a few of those in a little bit, but you don't need it, okay? You can disable it by adding an enable view state directive on the page directive. Just put it up there. Enable view state equals false, and your page won't go and jam extra things in there, okay? It's that much more content you're not sending over the wire. If you really want to bring down the hammer, you can turn it off in webconfig, okay? And that'll turn it off across the entire site. You will not be able to go back into a page and say, enable view state true. No. Because it's been shut off in webconfig, it ignores it the whole way across, okay? While I have this up, does anybody do enable view state Mac? Anybody? Really? Okay, here's the thing. Enable view state Mac, terribly insecure. Don't do it. In fact, when you upgrade to ASP.NET 4.5.2, they actually prevent you from turning it off, okay? It's, even if you have it turned off, it ignores it, okay? There was a security release that went out in the 4.5.1 update indicating that they're gonna start ignoring it. Any benefit that you thought you might have had, you're not actually getting, and they're taking care of that for you. So let's take a look at a little bit of a demo here where we're gonna create a giant view state and fix it. Yeah, I know. We're gonna fix view state. Can you believe it? So I have here, simple page. I'm not gonna do a lot of fancy CSS and JavaScript and make pages look really cool because what I want you to see is the core markup and the code behind this, okay? Break it down, let the designer people get in and take care of that stuff later. So I have just an H2, my game's for sale, and then I've got a grid, okay? And in my code behind, I'm actually going to bind to that grid down here in page load, right? You've probably seen syntax like this before. If page is not post back, game state equals games, or you're gonna fetch the data from wherever. I happen to be creating it up here in a list. And I'm going to put 1,000 games into this list, okay? Pretty straightforward. And the game is just a, let's show you what a game looks like so you have some idea. It's a simple object, ID, name, price, in stock. So I'm gonna load that up. After it loads up, I'm gonna put it in this game state property, which is, I'm gonna put it into view state, and then I'm gonna bind to my grid that collection. So let's take a look. So my grid comes up, and it's very simple, game 0 through 9, and I can page, great. Looks fine. View source. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. I'm still going. 8, 9. 9 pages of junk that your end users can't use. Okay? Why? Because I put it into view state and my grid has enable view state turned on. Okay? So it's actually in there twice. That's a bad thing. Look, Let's really take this to the next level, and let's look at how much network resources we're using. Let's just reload. Sure. Come here. Just to make sure. So now my default page is, let's reload this so we can lose that browser link stuff. Flush all my cache, there we go. 58.7K, and it's 413 milliseconds, okay? That's actually a lot for what little I'm showing on screen, okay? Let's start taking that stuff out. Don't put extra things into view state, okay? So instead of putting this back into view state, just reach back to the database or to your data source and fetch it again, okay? The grid might shift a little bit, but that's not gonna create a bad problem for your end users, particularly if you need to get in and do selection, if you use data key names, right? If you use that, then when people select things, it'll still find the appropriate object and move along to the next task, okay? So let's stop putting this stuff into view state. So I'm gonna take this, where did my cursor go? And instead of returning that, thank you, I'm gonna just return games and I'm not gonna let it be set, okay? So now if I rebuild, reload, now my size is 3.5K. Still got some in there because the grid is storing data about the information that was put in the grid, okay? Shut it off. So I'm gonna come up, go to the end here, enable view state, false, I don't even need to rebuild with this one. So I was at 3.5, now I'm down to 2.1. So I went to, what was it, 50K? Down to 2, right? Not bad. That's gonna make those phones, those tablets that are accessing your website run a lot faster, okay? So there's still a little bit there. So this is a question that I've had as well. There's still some things that happen in the background that ASP.NET is doing. There's still just a smidge of it, yeah. And that's stuff that we can't control. I'm okay with that little bit there. If you really, really want to get rid of it, there are tricks you can use to push view state server side and store it in session. But session's another taboo word among some people who are web developers. So take your pick. No. You're still going to get some, but that's a lot better than what we had before, right? So. But one thing that I like to do that just keeps me from even thinking about this, because when I put enable view state on the page, right, even though I put enable view state equals false, I can go through to my individual controls, and where I need to turn on view state, I can add it back in, right, as needed to different controls. What I like to do is I like to come through to the Visual Studio templates, okay? We want full screen. Here we go. So I'm way down in the bowels of this thing. Visual Studio 12, Common 7, IDE, item templates, C sharp, web. I've got this link for you later, so you don't have to quick scroll it down. But this is the template for a web form ASPX page. I like to come into one of these guys, and you have to edit it as an admin. So, go there, grab this guy, right? There's my template, shut it off so I never have to think about it again. I actually had to put that back in because I normally have it removed. Now when I come through and I say file new, well, add web form, yeah, sure, call it whatever. And it's there every time I start a new one. So now it's more of a thing where, oh, I need to turn it back on instead of going back through and saying, oh, yeah, turn it off on every page, okay? That's what I like to do. Your mileage may vary, all right? So view state. Let's get rid of that as frequently and as much as possible. Data source controls, right? I mentioned this earlier, the magic gray box, right? You would have the designer and you drag and you have this thing that appears and it's not showing you anything. Well, in the designer, right, where it was supposed to be valuable because you put it on the design surface, it's not testable. You can't unit test this thing. It's just sitting there in markup. You can't verify that it's actually accessing your data source properly. You can't reuse it. It's on the ASPX page. All right, maybe you can put it on an ASCX page, but now you're really playing with fire, dragging that thing around, because now you're creating more data connections to where? You don't know when you drag that ASCX onto your ASPX page. Man, that's a lot of acronyms. Look, the cardinal sin here is when people embed SQL statements in these things, right? Anybody see when they open an ASPX page and they see one of these things out there and you do a view markup and you see select star from products? Anybody see that? Yes. Okay, I'm not the only one in the room. So let's get rid of that. There's a better way to do this, something that came along in ASP.NET 4.5 called model binding. So I'm going to show you. Once again, my game's for sale, and I've got a SQL data source. Ugh. Why is that select there? And the worst part about it is the tool helps you do it. It does. Look. Configure data source. Specify columns. And it's building a select statement that it's going to embed. Microsoft is trying to help you fall into the pit of success, okay? This is a decision that was made a long time ago to make things work easily for people who were coming from VB6, right? Anybody remember VB6 in here? Anybody trying to forget VB6 in here? Okay, I actually saw more hands come up the second time. Which is funny because you don't remember it and you're still trying to forget it. We'll get back to that one. So, look, this is bad, right? Can we agree to this? Because, right, if your friendly DBA decides, well, I'm going to rename that table or turn it into a view and I'm going to move some of these columns around, now you go, you're scouring through all your ASPX pages. You've got 100, 200 of these pages in your application. You got to find everywhere that it, ooh, and find and replace only goes so far when you have a table named products. So look, don't do this, okay? Here's what you do instead. You use model binding. Now, model binding for the web forms developer is actually based on what the MVC framework has, okay? So when you do it in MVC, you get this really cool action thing that's happening from your controller, and you can bind back into incoming parameters. Neat. We can do that too. So when we have this grid view, instead of just pointing to my data source ID here, I'm going to get rid of that. And instead, I have my board game over here. And I've already created a board game repository. This actually points to an entity framework code first class context. We're good? Everybody's good with Entity Framework? Yes, I see plenty of nodding heads. Moving along. So I have this out there, and then I've got this repository that might inject whatever other business logic I might have. Okay? I've got a get method here that returns an iQueryable that's just my collection of games. So instead, I can say, you know what? Come here. I can say select method equals. And that was called get inside my repository. Now, when you start using these attributes here, Visual Studio is trying to help you, and it gives you the ability to say create new method. And that'll create a method with the appropriate signature in the code behind of this ASPX. Handy. However, I've already got a repository that does that stuff. So I'm going to show you kind of the advanced way to do this first, and then we'll back up and I'll show you the simple, how it's all sitting behind in a later demo. So instead of doing that, I did get. And then the secret sauce to this is actually called onCallingDataMethods. And I've already got a method out here called gridCallingDataMethods. I generated this earlier. And what that does is it says the data methods object for this model binding that we're doing is my board game repository. So now, instead of looking on the code behind of this page, it's going to look in the board game repository for the get method. Make sense? I've got enough people nodding. I'm going to show the next piece. So now it's going to call through to my board game repository. It's not going to use this thing. And my board game repository, that could be sitting inside of another DLL, right? It doesn't have to necessarily be here. I can have another team working on that. But for this, it's demoware. I've got it all in one project. So let's start this up. And you will see I get my games coming back, okay? Simple collection, it's coming from my database, it's going through my repository instead of using my SQL data source. Now I can test that, okay? Yes, I still have things in markup that say, here's where the grid's gonna go get its data, right? If you're really paranoid about how that grid's getting its data, wire it up in the code behind. This is easy, declarative, nothing to it, okay? Now, there are other methods that we can use to automatically wire up insert. There is no insert on a grid, but there's an insert method attribute. There's an update method attribute, and it'll automatically, I'm in debug mode, so it won't generate it. It'll automatically generate the signature for that. There's also a delete method. There it is. And it'll create a new method in the code behind for you. Okay? So these are ways for you to do your interactions with any data-bound web control without having to use a data source. Is that something you might use? Okay, I see a couple people nodding heads. So that is model binding, and it's a lot easier to test and verify, and now you've centralized all your data access or business logic that you might sit on top of that. So that also gets us into a post redirect get model as well, right? So instead of just doing a post back to this page and we're getting things refreshed, you can do a post back, then redirect somewhere else to do a get. So let's go to smartphones, the mobile web, right? How do we do that with web forms? I mean, right? I mentioned this briefly. A brave new web of devices. I mean, Windows CE, right? Did anybody have a CE device? Yes? Okay, I'm seeing maybe 10% of the room. Okay, so you know what I'm talking about. You had a start button down there that if you could get, I mean, I've got sausages for fingers. If I could get my finger to touch that without touching the Excel icon on my desktop above it, it was amazing. It was a good day. But I was always making phone calls at the same time I had Excel open for some reason. So modern smartphones were July 2007, right? Mr. Jobs and that fruity company in Cupertino, California, launched the iPhone, and things were good. Touch arrived, and all of our web pages weren't optimized for smaller screens, right? This was the first phone that did something to make those smaller screens consume the web better, right? How many of you do this when you go and you open the newspaper, or you go to one of your favorite blogs, and you start reading it on your phone, and you start doing this, right? Because you want to zoom in on just that column of stuff and all the ads down the right side? Wait till they figure out how to prevent you how to do that, and all the advertisers are going to be like, it needs to be there on the screen. So now we've got to optimize for those smaller screens. There were different standards because we were all running Internet Explorer 8. And when you looked at stuff in Internet Explorer 8, now it looks like this. It feels like somebody took a spray paint can to a Chevy and tried to make their own Batmobile. This is a real car. I was taking my dog to go get his shots, and I come out, and that's in the parking lot. Nice try, fella. Nice try. And that's the way I feel when I look at some people's websites that they haven't optimized for my Lumia or a Nexus or an iPhone. It's a nice try, but I can't squint that small anymore to be able to see what's going on your page. Touch-first interactions. If you're not developing and assuming that the first way that somebody's going to interact with your web page is with touch, you're missing out, okay? I'm not going to get into swipe, but let's think about at least touch interactions. That means that somebody's using a finger to access your page. That means that those hyperlink buttons might not always work. Because I don't know about you, when I'm looking, reading somebody's blog post and I try and touch a line of text in the middle there because they hyperlinked something out to Wikipedia, I end up hitting two or three lines of text at the same time, okay? So think about that as you start to build your pages with this. The recommendation is to use a responsive design framework and techniques so that you can make these things fit devices better, okay? Let me show you what I mean by that. And Microsoft has actually done something really cool for us by making it the default now. Check this out. So in the sample project that I have here, the default ASPX is here, and I'm actually going to just launch this default page. I'm already built, so I don't need to relaunch. And it looks like that, right? Everybody's seen this by this point, right? Okay. So when you start Visual Studio 2013 and you do a one ASP.NET project, you get this, no matter whether you're choosing web forms or MVC. Great. This is a Bootstrap framework page. So I've got a nice nav bar across the top. I've got this, what they call the Jumbotron in the middle. And then they've got three columns of information down at the bottom. But what's really nice about this, and when you start to experiment with it, is that it resizes appropriately for smaller screens. And there's breakpoints as you see the browser change shape. This is the way for us as desktop developers to kind of feel that out, is I can start to resize my browser and see what happens when I get to about the width of maybe a tablet in landscape mode or portrait, right? Things start to stack, right? I've still got all my content, but it's moved in a way that makes it appear better for me, right? And as I get smaller and smaller, things start to move around again, right? See, font size changed, and this thing appeared in the corner. Anybody call that thing something like a hamburger? Hamburger, I see a couple people. Cheeseburger. My coworkers in Europe said to me, "You American, what calling it a cheeseburger? Look at that." Now, grippy, I've heard people call it a grippy. I'm trying to come to a consensus as to what this thing is besides three bars. It's a thingy. Thank you, sir. I'm going to just call it the thingy. I've heard people call it the menu button. Yes? Menu button? Menu button, okay. All right, so I'm hearing we're going to agree on calling it the menu thingy, whatchamacallit. Huh? I'm going to coin that. Menu thingy, whatchamacallit.com. So, look, that's nice. You can resize your browser and make that work. I like to use Chrome when I'm doing my development. I'm going to tinker with responsive web design because Chrome has an awesome emulator set in it. Okay? And I know I'm saying this at a Microsoft show, but it's okay. I'm an MVP, not an employee. So, Chrome's actually embedded information about the different device sizes and bit depths here inside the developer tools, okay? Let me show you how I did that again. So I pressed F12 to bring up the developer tools bar down here at the bottom. Press escape, and it brings up this panel at the bottom that'll show you console, let you search, but the one that I want is emulation, okay? The first bit here is device, and I can choose what device do I want to make Chrome resize to. Okay, so I've got all my favorites here that have white cables, all my favorites sitting here from Google. My favorite, my Nokia Lumia, and I can click emulate. And it will resize immediately. Now, I need to refresh to actually get it to repaint in there appropriately, and that looks really small, so let me drag that down. And my page resizes appropriately. Now, there's a little bit of device detection going on here. But there it's resized appropriately with the bootstrap. Okay, we'll show you that. It was kind of a sneak preview of what's going to happen later. We'll get back to that. So this resized nicely. But what happens when I take my phone and turn it sideways? So I can come back into my emulator here. And on the screen tab, I can actually click this. And it changes the size. And it still looks and feels good, right? So when you start to think about having your website target people who are going to be using mobile devices to access your content, start doing this. Start getting in there, seeing what it looks like on different size devices. You don't need to go and expense with your boss a half dozen different devices of different sizes, shapes, and all that stuff. It's a great way to get your hands on a Kindle Fire, but you can do it right here. So that's how we can work with the responsive framework to make things appear, but I've only shown you the effect of it. How do you actually do it? So I've written a sample here that I wanted to make, move things around, be pretty straightforward, pretty simple, and something that, well, people will like. Because I like cats. So let's reset here. There we are. Everybody likes cats. So I've got six cats going across, okay? And this is actually inside that bootstrap grid. We have 12 virtual columns going across. And at different device sizes, those columns will move and stack appropriately. What I can do as the developer is I can specify that these cats are in a row, right? So I have this div that wraps my cat images. And I'm using the placekitten.com service because I need cat pictures. So this specifies the size, and by putting a G in there, it makes them black and white. Anyways, so classes. Now, in Bootstrap, you specify your column widths by referring to a CSS class that starts with col. You specify the device size, small, SM, extra small is actually XS, medium, MD, large is LG, and there is no extra large. That's it. It's just those four. And then a hyphen, and then the number of columns that you want to allocate on that responsive grid to that div, okay? So my large width browser, I've got six cats going across, six gazintas 12 two times. I was trying to explain to my daughters one time what gazintas were. I don't think they use that term in school anymore. Anyways. Oh, yeah, you're learning your gazintas. So what I want to do is I want to make these two playful kittens. You see them here. I want to make them disappear on the smaller device sizes. So I can specify hidden-MD, hidden-SM, and hidden-XS to hide that column when that size browser is looking at the content. Okay? So if I start to resize this, man, the browser just is giving away all the good stuff. So as I start to resize and I hit that breakpoint, it's making things disappear. Now, the corollary to this is when you're putting content on your web application, you can put these CSS classes on any div, any block display element, right? But there's going to be stuff that you really aren't going to want to show on those smaller devices. It doesn't make sense. Those things that it doesn't make sense to show on smaller devices, put those hidden CSS classes on and make them disappear. Okay? And further, as I get smaller and smaller here, I actually hit another breakpoint and I stack it 2x2. So maybe on a tablet it makes sense to show it this way. It's much more comfortable, right? But these are design decisions that you're going to get help with your web designer. Okay? You need to figure out how your content best fits. Because even when you get all the way down to that mobile device, they're all going to be stacked. Okay? So, cats, responsive, not bad. Yes, sir? On a smaller device, if you're hiding some of those things, they're still delivered. So this is strictly a client-side capability. So yeah, you're still shipping that stuff over the wire. There are ways to not ship that stuff over the wire. Come see me afterwards and we can talk about it. So that is a little bit about Bootstrap, okay, and the responsive capabilities that you can do to make this stuff fit better on a mobile device. So let's go to the next slide. Yes. There we go. CSS and JavaScript, and you've got happy designers. Right, there's a bloat of static frameworks right now, right? CSS framework, so you have style sheets for Bootstrap. There's a Bootstrap theme you're going to want to put down. There's Zurb Foundation you might use. And then you're going to have control-specific styling you're going to lay down. So it's got specific items for this grid you bring in and that button set that you use. You might have master page layout-specific styling you're doing. Oh, my gosh. And now we have JavaScript libraries coming into play. I need to reference jQuery and jQuery UI and Kendo UI and Modernizer and more JavaScript libraries because they just keep changing every 6 months. Bootstrap, responsive, knockout, angular, require. It's a lot you're going to end up jamming on a page, right? The solution the ASP.NET team has for you is bundles. There's two config files that we can use out of the box. Bundleconfig.cs, where we'll configure our JavaScript bundles, and bundle.config. Okay? What the bundles will do, if you saw Mad's session a little bit earlier, he did a little bit of this. What it will do is it'll take all your JavaScript and all your CSS, put them together in one file, concatenate them together, compress it, and then serve it with a very long expiration time. So let's take a look at how we can configure that and the benefit it gives us. Oh, okay. So let's take a look. So here is, right, you might have a page like this. This is a kind of a rip on a page that I had somebody give to me a little bit earlier in the month, but I've got five JavaScript references, and I've got three CSS links, and if you know anything about the modern browsers, they can't request more than 4 or 6 files at a time. So I'm going to be hanging up waiting for some of these things to load while other things are still coming down. That's a problem. I don't actually have anything else on this page because I want to demonstrate to you just the raw amount of size that these things are taking up and how long it takes, okay? So let's take a look at what our performance is to start, right? Bare bones, quite literally, nothing on the page. So now, take a look at the network. Don't need the emulation for this. So now with all those files, and you see here, not you, go away. See how it's waiting for some of these until after the other ones are loaded? Okay? That could be a problem. You might see some blips in your content because it's waiting for CSS to come down while other CSS is being parsed. Okay? That could be a problem. So let me show you how to configure the bundles. There's two locations. I'll start with the CSS. It sits right here on the root. This is where it comes by default when you start a new ASP.NET project. And I've put those three CSS files in here. So I specify a style bundle, the path that I want ASP.NET to answer for that style bundle, and then the files I'm going to jam in there. Okay? The JavaScript is, it's C#. And I say bundles.add, it's a script bundle, and then I include and list the files that I want to include. Okay? I'll wait, this young lady's taking a photo. All right, cool. So I'm going to come over here, and instead of sending down all this, yes, I'm going to comment by hand. There we go. So control KU does a mass uncomment. So I'm going to reference just those two files. Now, over here, right, it was 3.7K across 664 milliseconds, 10 requests. Now, with those changes, two files, come on, four requests, 298K, 673 milliseconds. So we improved in time, everything came down and rendered at once, and it's got long expiration, so every time I refresh, it's pulling it out of cache. Cool. Doesn't have to go back for those big files anymore, all right? So try to start using this because it'll save you bandwidth and it'll increase the performance of your application, okay? I believe it's a 4.0. Let me double check on that. Drop me a line on Twitter and I'll get back to you. I'm C Sharp Fritz on Twitter. Yeah, I know. So, all right, let's move on to, oh, I like the next one. The ugly URLs problem, right? I can't read this to my mother. Cool website, products, details ASPX, and even if I try and fit that in a text message for her to click, there's nothing else I can write with it, right? So it's hard to convey that, and you're going to end up turning that into a bit.ly link or a t.co link if you try and tweet it. So let's use something called friendly URLs. Now, this became available to us in 2012. It's in .NET 4.5, and later, it comes through automatically activated for you, okay? Now, you can add it on if you're in Visual Studio 2012. And what it does is it takes advantage of the route table that's in every ASP.NET project. It will drop off the .aspx's and the file name requests and a whole lot more, all right? So we're going to configure that inside of route config. There's your install package line if you have to go get it on NuGet. And it does mobile device detection. Ooh. Let me show you what that means. So this is sitting inside of app start route config. Here it is. Okay, now there's some settings that are coming in here, mostly because I'm going to flip back and forth between these modes, and if I have it permanently rerouting me on stage, it's not going to show appropriately for you as I try and show turning this on and off. So you don't need to do all of this. You really just need to say routes.enable friendly URLs. Now with that, I can have a search page sitting out here that I can navigate to. And you see the search, five demo search ASPX, drop the ASPX, okay? So this is using model binding techniques on the page. There, select method. And I'm generating a hyperlink that goes to 5demo edit. And I'm jamming the ID on the end of there because I want to be able to click on that edit link and go to an edit page, okay? Now, this edit page, see what the URL is? edit/2. Two? What's it doing with the two? In the code behind of this, where I do my get, right? So here we're doing model binding. I have this is called a value provider. And it's saying in the friendly URL folder segments, in the zero-width segment, go grab that value and pass that into me as the ID. Cool. That's easy to figure out. And then all I'm doing is reaching out to my entity framework context and saying, go find it. Return that object. On my page, it's just an ASP form view, and I have a select method sitting out there, right, that points back to what I just showed you. This item type, that makes this my binding strongly typed. So now instead of saying eval quotes magic string for field name, I can say item dot. And it knows what my object looks like. Cool. Because now I get compile time errors instead of when it runs and doesn't find my field that changed names. That's a problem, right? So I also wanted to show dynamic entities here. This is something you can add into your projects so that ASP.NET will dynamically generate the labels, the validation, and the data entry fields for your objects. You don't have to build it. It's already sitting out there templated in this dynamic data folder. And here's all the templates for those common data types. Okay? So if you want to change these so it does something else, just reach into here and change them up. Right? It's simple ASPX, ASCX page. Change them to your heart's content. Now that's added through NuGet, the dynamic data. If I can, oh, it's not going to show. There it is. Dynamic data template CS will get you that automatic rendering of objects, okay? So great, I've got this page that will edit for me, and I can look at it, and I can see that it's passing this really nice formatted URL back and forth, okay. And when I click cancel, it goes back to my search page. But I mentioned that it will do mobile device detection, okay? The route table will look at the request header and see what the browser is that's requesting it. If the browser requesting it is something that it deems mobile, it'll reach down and say, is there a .mobile.aspx file? If there is, it'll return the content that instead of the .aspx file. So check this out. I'm going to turn on my emulator again. And I'm going to make this an iPhone 4. So it's resized appropriately, but I need to request to actually trigger ASP.NET's interaction with it. And now if I say, come on. So now I can paint something else that looks and feels appropriate for that device, right? If you didn't know that was a web page, you might think it belongs on an iPhone. So all that I'm doing in that edit page, it's the exact same types of content. Yay. I'm referencing an open source CSS library that does mobile device rendering for me. I've got a form view. And then, oh, that's the edit. Let me go back to search. I was showing you search. So I've got those libraries. And then I've got a list view that just outputs ULs. And it's saying that this is a data role list view. And then my CSS library is taking care of the rest. Pretty cool. Now, the advantage of this CSS library is it actually detects the device that's requesting it and applies appropriate skins to it. So if I were to change this and say I'm using a Google Nexus and refresh, it makes it that appropriate black theme that you have on the newer Android devices. Right? Or if I go and choose a Nokia, right? So it has that metro look and feel, so I have a list that's kind of indented and they're all hyperlinks that I can click on and get to something else. Okay? So there's a bunch of CSS libraries out there. This is one. This is Kendo UI. Check out other ones out there, IUI, jQuery Mobile. There's a bunch that'll help you do exactly this so that you can make your application look like it belongs on that device. Cool? Is that something you might use? Okay, cool. Oh, thank you. So let's move on. I have the next piece that I want to show you. So we had an XHTML standard way back when in 2005. 2005, that was before my kids were born, okay? That's how long ago that was, right? The output way back when was standard XML, right? And we know HTML5 is the new standard. The support for HTML5 in Visual Studio is amazing, okay? We already know there's lots of new tags and attributes and support for device services that we can hit. And we've got these new super languages, right? These superset languages like LESS and SAS and TypeScript and CoffeeScript. You want to be able to use them. So make sure you get Visual Studio up to date. I don't care if you go and get the Web Express edition. Use it, it'll make your editing experience so much better. And there's a really cool feature in there called Browser Link. So let me show you some of the things that you can do with HTML5 on your pages. So I have So there's now all different kinds of text modes you can apply to a text box. And Visual Studio, of course, supports it with a text mode attribute. When I run this, right, this is 6. Chrome sees these and gives me appropriate data entry widgets for those data types, right? Color is a color picker. I mean, do you really want to type in RGB values or blue when you could say, no, I want that one. And date is an actual date picker here that I can use, right? And this is something the browser is giving me for free, right? Some of these also are optimized for phones, like, for example, email, right? When you hit that text box on a phone, you're going to get the at symbol appear down on the bottom, maybe, and the .com, .org button appear down there so you can type in somebody's email address without having to go to the next page of characters so you can go find the at sign. Same thing with the phone number, right? You want it to be a nice numeric keypad so people can key in a phone number quick. So Chrome has the best support for this stuff. Internet Explorer, it's coming along. But the danger with how Chrome has implemented this stuff is they like to change it on the fly without telling us. So if you're going to start to use some of these things, just be careful and watch the next version of Chrome that comes out. Because our friends in Mountain View, they're making a lot of changes quickly, and you're going to want to keep up with them. So lots of text box capabilities now to make data entry easier. We can now do other new elements, like, well, device. This is device services. Man, that's badly named. So there are device services that we can hit, like GPS. And it's not finding my GPS. I bet you the network here is blocking it. If you're on a device that supports GPS, like a phone, like a tablet, and you're on a network that will allow the GPS coordinates to come down, the browser can display that information, maybe put a pin on a map, that kind of thing. It's a little bit of JavaScript. So you go out and say navigator geolocation, geolocation get current position, and you give it a callback. When that callback fires, it's under coordinates.latitude and coordinates.longitude. Yeah, and I'm not going to get any GPS information. The other thing we can do here is we can detect if the network is connected. There's actually an event that fires called online and another one that fires called offline. All right, here we go. This is for the big win. I'm going to pull my network cable. Let's see if it changes. So maybe you're going to take appropriate action to store data inside local storage, right? There's now a key value pair storage that's available in the browser that you can work with, right? And that'll always be there when people come back to your website. That's the key, when people come back to your website. Because if they don't have the browser open when they come back online, it won't do anything to resync or work with that data to get it back to your web server. So that's one thing you're going to need to be aware of. However, if somebody's on a train that goes through a tunnel and they're working on your website and they're making changes and whatever, and you're saving the stuff to local storage, and they hit save and you're still offline, and you just say, okay, I'm saving it to local storage, but when you come, you give them a nice message box that says, when you next come online, I'm going to send it back. And they come out of that tunnel and they're still looking at your website, you can take advantage of that and act appropriately, okay? So it's just an event sitting out there on the window object. And then you detect the status by saying navigator.online. And for some reason, the L's capitalized. I don't know why. America Online didn't have a capital L, so I guess it wasn't Americans who did that. Or was it? So there's something else that we can do. There's new tags that we can hit, like audio and video. So I can put an audio tag out here and add sources to it of all different types. And by default, when I start typing an audio element here, say Visual Studio will give me some completion there. And when I tab, it'll start to fill this in, right? So I can specify, here's alternate sources if your browser won't support MP3 and would prefer to play Ogg Vorbis. But by default, it puts up a nice little play bar there, and I don't have to worry about Flash or Silverlight or some other plugin, right? Just by using audio, and there's a video tag as well, I can get a multimedia experience, right? So now Phil in accounting can't complain that he can't access your training videos you put online anymore. So just put it in with a video tag, and everybody can see it.
And of course, it plays. Episode 855 with guest.
Yes, me. That was my episode. So that's audio. And the last one that's kind of the tricky one is you can trigger the camera on devices. Now, not all devices support it, not all browsers support it. It's supposed to be supported, but those companies that are a little squeamish about security and web pages being able to turn on a camera at will haven't implemented this yet. However, our friends at Google have. So, I have a video tag here, and I say, Navigator, get user media. I want video, and here's what you do with the stream. There's different prefixes they put in front of this, those vendor prefixes. So this one's WebKit get user media, and it does very much the same thing. Create an object URL from the stream that gets fed in and send it over to the video player. So Chrome politely asks, I'd like to use your camera. And it turns on the camera, right? I've got the green light turns on my device, unlike when the NSA turns it on. And I can do something with this, right? There are ways to wire this up so you can take a picture, save that off. Maybe you are doing something where you want to take a picture of people who come into the front door to your office building so you can save it off and see who's been interacting there. And I'm realizing I'm doing this a lot. So lots of things that you can do with this, lots of possibilities. Oh, and Chrome also gives you this little red dot to indicate, yes, the camera's on this tab, even though you're over here. Aww. So, there's a couple of simple new things that are in HTML5 that you might be interested in. Anything there you're interested in? You might want to use? Cool. Okay, I'm seeing more than half of you saying, yeah! Let me move on. The last thing, the most important thing that nobody wants to hear about, but we've all got to pay attention to. It's 2014. We've got to worry about security, right? If you're building a website, somebody can break into it, not just the NSA. I love to pick on them. Look, in the past, webconfig defines security, right? Your authentication credentials from Active Directory, you told it you wanted Active Directory authentication or forms authentication, right? And you authorized on a folder-by-folder basis. There was no integration with third-party providers. You had to write your own service, right? You had to plug in your own thing so you could go and save stuff into your own database if you wanted to, or figure out how you were going to request authentication information from Facebook so you can get that into it. ASP.NET Identity was just released in April, I want to say. And it's the next generation of ASP.NET security, okay? It's built for OWIN. It's built for all the really cool things that we saw in the keynotes at the beginning of the week, okay? There's easy integration with Active Directory and SQL. And all the hooks are there for you to light up your Microsoft account validation, Facebook, and Twitter, and Google. So, look, I didn't even write a demo for this one. That's how much I believe in it. Seriously, it's a solid piece of code. It's amazing. And I know the team is probably back in Washington going, so look, I'm going to start a new ASP.NET web application. Web forms. I want individual user accounts, right? This is one of those cool new dialogues that just makes security simple for us. If you wanted to set up Windows authentication, you come in here and you specify your information. It is on premises, and you hook up stuff appropriately to your Active Directory. At the end, I'm going to give you a bit.ly bundle that has links to blog posts on how to do this if you do need to do Active Directory or any other single sign-on type of mechanism, okay? But I'm going to focus on individual. And no, I don't want Azure right now because I'm demoing in front of you good people. So watch in the lower left corner, adding jQuery, modernizer, bootstrap, blah, blah, blah. There it went by. Did you see it? Missed it. Missed it by that much. So look, everything starts now in startup CS with the new OWIN capabilities, right? OWIN startup, okay? And we're gonna configure authentication from here. When I step into that, now we get into the meat and potatoes of this. I'm gonna create contexts, and there's plumbing going on here. Never fear, it's not that bad. When you come down here, this is where I can say uncomment lines to turn on third-party login providers. So if you already have a application installed and running with either your Microsoft account or Twitter or Facebook or Google, uncomment these lines appropriately, grab your API keys out of their service, drop them in here, and the magic will happen. The other piece to this before I show you the magic that happens is, hi mom, I heard the phone. It's over here in identity config, that's it. And this is where we now specify the application user. So we have a manager, we have a password validator that has all those wonderful rules that our security friends like to impose on us, right? Just saying. It's more secure that way. So, down here is the really cool part that they've already built for us, and you just need to provide a shim if you want it. Two-factor authentication, okay? They've already got written the pieces to register a two-factor authentication provider, okay? And the service that will handle that, there's a template one sitting here for you, and all it's doing right now is saying, yes, passed. Passed two-factor authentication. So they've actually got it already wired up and running. But I would encourage you, if you do want to do two-factor authentication, grab these methods, hook up with a service like Twilio. This message was not paid for by Twilio. And you can do this very easily to send text messages out or send emails out, okay? Why not? If it's that easy to do and you need to secure your website, just do it. I mean, it's a dozen lines of code. Somebody's probably got it already written. In fact, by the time this gets posted on Channel 9, it probably will be. Look, with those couple things in play and with my interesting security hookup, when I start this new application, nothing up my sleeves, brand new application, and I go and say register, and I give it what password, what email am I going to show you? And click register, and it'll register my account. Now, that's nice. What's really nice is behind the scenes, what it did for me, not that one, it's this one, is it automatically generated a database for me with the appropriate tables. This is being done with Entity Framework code first. It went and scaffolded these tables for me so that I can come in here and say show table data, and I can see there's my user ID, there's my password hash, which is nothing like what I typed in, and there's other information there along the way. If I wanted to expand my identity, if I wanted to have more features on there, right? If I wanted to store, I don't know, birth date, hair color, eye color, I don't know, whatever. The user object is this application user here, okay? When I go into that, it has these two methods defined by default. But you can add on the other properties, and it will scaffold that table appropriately for you so that you can start to collect that information on the profile and store with your user information, okay? If that's indeed user security critical information you want to store there and not in some other profile table, because you do want to store hair color with somebody's password. I don't know, maybe. So that's the new security model. It comes out of the box really, really secure. Oh, I didn't show you what these things look like. So if I go and uncomment one of these, and if I had a client ID and if I had a secret here, next time I come in, oh, there we go. Log off, log in. And it will start to add these providers because they've been registered as OAuth providers. And you'd be able to click on it, and it'll go out and take you to the Microsoft account login page, and you can log in with your Microsoft account. Cool. Is this something you guys might use? Yes, okay, cool. I see about a third of you saying, I want that. Cool. All right. That's all the demos I have. So I've got some wrap-up slides here. Please visit me, particularly, in the Developer Platform and Tools booth. I'll be over there in the ASP.NET area in purple, same color as my shirt. If you have any questions about this or about things made by Telerik, my employer, we'll be over there. I can answer some questions for you. There's all kinds of resources out there. Visual Studio Integrate. What I want you to go to, though, is my Bitly bundle that has, it doesn't have these slides. You'll be able to get these slides with your tech ed resources. But the source code I showed you today and a couple other blog posts, go to bit.ly, right? bit.ly/Fritz, F-R-I-T-Z, T-E, 14. Okay? Fritz, T-E, 14. If you remember nothing else, if you don't remember anything about view state I said earlier, Fritz TE14, and you'll get all the source code to this. Please, please, please complete an evaluation about this session. You might win a prize. If you say good things about me, I might win the prize of coming back next time. And you can evaluate by taking a picture of this QR code. Give me all high scores, man. If not, come tell me why. And maybe I can help you out, figure out what we can do to make your ASP.NET experience better. I believe that's the last slide. Yeah. I'm going to leave the QR code up in case anybody wants to use it so they can give me all perfect scores. Thank you.